welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today's Monday, March 25th, and I'm Cara Santa Maria. Thank you so much for joining me. It's going to be a great episode this week. Now, remember, Talk Nerdy Ism will always be 100% free to download, and that's because of the model that we use for the show that we've used almost from the beginning. I sell ads. Those are right in the middle of the show, generally one or two to break things up, but also I really heavily rely on support from listeners just like you. One of the biggest ways that you can support the show is by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy. That's patreon.com/talknerdy. And you can pledge your support from episode to episode. I mean, as little as a few bucks an episode is just a massive, massive help. But if you pledge more, you get a shout out on the show. So this week, I want to thank Pedro M., Rosario Barbosa, Phil Tiber, the zombie drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much for your support. Of course, there's a lot of other ways to support the show. They don't have to be financial. You can rate and review on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, or any other place where you download your shows. You can share about the show on social media, share about it with your friends and family. But if you do want to rock some cool Talk Nerdy swag, you can visit talknerdymerch.com. M-E-R-C-H, like merchandise? Yeah. And you can see all sorts of super cool Talk Nerdy swag there, including things like t-shirts and tank tops and hoodies and socks and mugs and, you know, all those kinds of things, but also signed books. I've got both the Almanac 2019 and the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe book. Oh, and I still think I have some Charlie and the Tortoise books as well. I wrote the foreword for that book. It's a kid's book and it's super, super cute. All right, let's talk about this week's show. It's going to be a good one. So I got to chat with Rose Eveleth, and you probably already know who Rose is, but if you don't, she's a producer, designer, writer, and animator, and she now lives in Berkeley. Prior to that, she was in New York City. She's written for all sorts of super cool outlets like Wired, BBC Future, Motherboard, Nautilus. She's done stuff for Story Collider. She worked on the 30 for 30 podcast for ESPN, but you probably know her by being the producer and the host of Flash Forward, which is a really kick-ass podcast all about the future. So we're going to talk about all things future, a little bit of things past, and yeah, just really cool stuff with a really, 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 really cool woman. So without any further ado, here she is, Rose Eveleth. Well, Rose, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Yes. So we tried to do this earlier in the week, but it rained a little bit in LA. So my internet, of course,
the world
didn't
ended.
Work.
Yeah.
But you were so kind to quickly respond to my panicked email that I sent through my iPhone and my panicked, direct message on Twitter. And you were like, no, it's cool. So. Now
yeah, I do tend to open emails with the subject line urgent.
I felt so bad. I was like, I gotta get a hold of
this. This must be important.
So, but you now know about me. I will not abuse the urgent subject line. I will only use it in emergency. But of course, now we're recording on a Saturday, which means one of two things. Either you're very passionate or like me, you don't have much of a life outside of work.
Both. A little bit of both. Yeah.
So I'm super thrilled to be chatting with you because you're one of these folks that I feel like our careers have crossed paths a million times. And we were talking before we started rolling that we must have met in the early days of Science Online, which was this really great conference for kind of early SciComm bloggers and podcasters and YouTubers and things like that. We must have met there at least once. We have all the same friends. We have worked for similar outlets. And, you know, I'm really inspired by your work. And it's just funny that we don't like hang out every day.
I know. Well, I'll be in LA at some point soon, so we should hang out.
Oh, cool. And I'll definitely let you know when I'm in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So you're not in San Francisco proper. You're in Berkeley.
I'm in Berkeley. Yes. Yeah. We just moved here about a year ago. Actually, we're coming up on a year of being in Berkeley, and I moved from New York, from Brooklyn. So, you know, the only city that's not cheaper than New York. We were like, let's go there.
But you know what, Berkeley? Weather-wise, it's really different, even though it's still frigidly cold, but it's in its own way. But like vibe-wise, I could see some crossover with Brooklyn.
Yeah, yes and no. You know, like at some moments I'm like, oh yeah, I got this. And other moments I'm like, oh, I'm gonna murder every person here. Just because like there's so chill. And like, that's part of why we moved here, right? Is for the kind of just to calm down a little bit. There's beautiful nature. Everyone's a little bit more chill. But there are also moments where I'm like, you've been in line with the menu in front of you for 10 minutes and you still don't know what you want. And I'm like in behind people just like, I'm gonna do a murder in this very nice hip coffee shop. Like it's just like there are moments where I just can't do it, but it's so great. Funny. Like it is great. So yeah, there's some people are often like, oh yeah, Berkeley is like the Brooklyn of the West. And I'm a little bit like, not really, but it is, I mean, there are some similar things that go on here, right? Yeah. We still have like, you know, there's some crossover for sure.
People say that about my neighborhood too, because I live in Los Feliz, which is like the sister kind of town to Silver Lake in Los Angeles. And people always say that's like Williamsburg, but same thing. It's not. You could just shoot Silver Lake for Williamsburg. Like the buildings look kind of the same.
Yeah,
the
for
people
sure.
are not the same. But I have to admit, I'm the opposite. When I'm in New York, which I've spent, you know, I live there for only 1 year, but I spend a lot of time there for work. I'll be standing in line at like a Duane Reade. And when the person at the checkout counter is like, next, like being so aggressive. I'm
whoa. No, those are my people.
Yeah. Holds off. For sure. I'm trying to get my money. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, those are truly my people. And there are definitely moments here where I have annoyed people, where I come across as like a little too brusque, where I'm sort of like, okay, like we're done with this conversation. Like we don't actually, like we're not going to be friends. Like we can just continue on with our lives. Like, you know, and yeah. And I think there are definitely moments where people think I'm like a huge asshole.
Anybody listening that lives in Hawaii right now is like, whoa, I do not want to visit. Like, I know. Every time I spend time in Hawaii, I have the same kind of thing where I'm like, wow, people are just not in a hurry here. But
yeah,
it's true. Different cultures, different kind of societal vibes. I don't know, but don't you feel like it's kind of good for your heart to not be
100%. Yeah. Every time I like get riled up, my partner's always like, this is literally why we moved here. Like, don't get to complain about this and also be like, we need to leave New York because everyone here is like too much, you know? So yeah, it is for sure good. I think there are just moments where it like boils over for me where I'm like, who are you people?
And of course, you know, I think that in many ways it parallels with the kind of work that, you know, both of us really do being freelancers. So you've been writing for ages. Like you have contributed to so many different outlets. You've been a columnist, a contributor, or even an editor for like, oh my gosh, I'm looking at your website right now. It's like every byline you can imagine, but definitely like Vice, Motherboard, Fusion, 538, places that you think of when you think of sort of SciComm, but also with a tech vibe, but things like The Atlantic, Refinery 29. I really like that outlet. Motherboard, 30 for 30. That's a really cool one because I love that crossover with sports and I'm obsessed with the 30 for 30 video series is the podcast. So you helped launch that podcast. How does it relate to the documentary series?
Yeah, so it's the same umbrella. So we worked within the film team. And, you know, basically 30 for 30 looked around and said, there are all these podcasts that are happening. You know, what, you know, we should be able to do this too. And we were brought in to kind of figure out how do you make 30 for 30, right? With that same kind of ethos of the films that are so good, right? Like I've been obsessed with them for forever. And how do you kind of turn that into a podcast? And that was kind of our job, was to figure that out. So the first season, I worked on the first season and it's 5 episodes. And they're really, you know, they're their own stories. They are not adaptations of the films. They're standalone sort of documentary audio projects. And they really are sort of meant to be the podcast version of what a 30 for 30 film would be. I mean, obviously you can't show stuff, but we still really rely heavily on archival audio, you know, like playing tape from the time, you know, looking back into the, you know, coverage and kind of giving you that thing where you think you might know about this particular event or moment or person in sports history, but here's a story you don't actually know, you know, the behind the scenes and stuff like that. So it really is, you know, it's sort of a foil to the documentary series as just an audio version of that kind of same storytelling ethos.
I love that because, you know, something that has always, I think, resonated with me about probably the best two examples would be 30 for 30 and maybe real sports or maybe inside the NFL is that I don't really like sports like at all. Like I'm not really that interested in sports, but good storytelling is good storytelling.
Yeah, totally. I love that. Like my favorite thing when I was hired and we had our first meetings trying to figure out like, what is it? What is 30 for 30, right? Like what is this brand that has such a really strong, like, you know, reputation? And my favorite thing to hear about either the films or the podcast is people saying exactly that, where they're like, I don't actually really like sports, but I love 30 for 30, you know, because it's just like a good story is a good story. And sports have those like elements of the good story, right? They're like, you know, there's always an underdog, you know, there's often someone fighting against a system. There's often kind of like these, all the things you want, right? In a really good story, sports really provide, they provide sort of a built-in conflict, right? Because there's like teams versus each other or people versus each other. So it has a lot of stuff like that. And so I think that the cool thing about 30 for 30 and working on 30 for 30, maybe more than working on some of the other more really sports fan driven publications or places, is that you do get a lot of people who don't really care about sports, but love these stories. Cause like the stuff we do a lot of the time, it's like, I mean, even I love sports and I'm like a huge sports fan. But there are some sports where I'm like, do I really care? Like baseball is like the sport I don't care about, which is terrible to admit. And if you like say that at ESPN, people are like, leave. But I just like, I don't care about the 76 Braves. Like I just don't, you know what I mean? And so like, but if you can make me care via these like really good stories, that's kind of the thing for me where I'm like, oh, now I care. Now I want to know everything about it. There's this great, actually not a 30 for 30, but there's a great documentary called Harvard Beats Yale 39-39, I think is the title. Okay. And it's this like old school Harvard Yale football game, which like is everything I should not care about, right? Like I don't care about Harvard. I don't care about Yale. Like I don't care about like old timey height, like college football, but this, it's such a good film. It like just lays it all out and it gives you this like really cool context for what happened and all that stuff. So yeah. So I love that. Like getting people who are like, yeah, sports, not really for me, but I like these.
Ugh, it's cool. And I love archival shit too, I have to admit. Yeah. I stayed up really late last night. My boyfriend and I watched the second half of the Michael Jackson documentary on HBO, which was like rough. But I do highly recommend it. We could talk about that later if we want. But right after it, I was like, I don't want to go to sleep, even though it was like 1 a.m. So I opened up my iPad and I am really obsessed with PBS documentaries. So I watch Frontline all the time and I love American Experience. So I was scrolling through episodes of American Experience and I watched one about the flu of 1918 and it was like fascinating. It was all archival. And it that stuff sings to me. And it's funny because I don't know if that makes me an old lady or if I think with kind of new media and how jump cutty it is and how much it's like pack all this information, how the slow Ken Burns vibe of it all is like for some reason really appealing to me.
Yeah, I think also like there is something about seeing it, right? Or like hearing it, where it's like, you know, you can have someone tell you what it's like at the time, or you can have someone tell you what it looked like, or even see photos of it. But like watching people move around in that space or hearing what it sounded like, there is something about that to me that is so alluring. And that like, anytime I come across a little like pocket of just cool archival stuff, I'm always like, oh yes, like this is this amazing window into a time, even if it's just like regular people walking around in like the 60s, it still feels like you're spying almost on these people who like, you know, and you're kind of, you get this like voyeuristic look into a time in a world where like I wasn't alive, I could never access. And so there is, archival stuff is so cool. And like the most fun thing about there are many fun things about working at 30 for 30, but one of the really fun things was digging up a lot of that archival and then watching it. So we worked with some really incredible archival researchers who literally their job is to like go find obscure archival footage where you're like, tell me, like I did a story about women who went to the North Pole. And I was like, can you pull like literally just anything that any publication ever did about these people, like anything the BBC did, anything like local news stations did in, you know, the UK. And so they would come back with like hours and hours of this footage and you would just sit down and watch it. And it was so cool to like sit down. And then the coolest part for that one was that I actually interviewed a lot of the women who went on this trip, which are all these women who had really no experience. None of them had ever been mountaineering. Most of them had never been camping before. And they like decided they wanted to go to the North Pole, which like is really dangerous. And so it's a story about like these sort of plucky women in the UK deciding they want to do this. And one of them was like, oh, I think I actually have some footage from our trip, like from the North Pole. And no she way. Found it and she sent it to me. And it was just like this moment of like, like watching them like in the tent, you know, dragging their sleds across the ice, even just the sound of the sleds, like dragging across the ice. Like I can't replicate that sound. Like I could try, you know, I could come up with some Foley and like, you know, do some experiments and try to make it sound like that. But actually having it was just like so cool. So yeah, I'm totally with you on the archival stuff.
Oh my gosh, I love that so much. I have to ask, and this has like nothing to do with your work or my work or anything, but I was in DC with the SGU and we had some downtime late at night and we all wanted to go to the movies. And Steve recommended that we go see They Shall Not Grow Old. Have you had a chance to see it?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay. So for people who don't know, I think it's still in theater. So I highly recommend
this. Yeah, I think so.
And this is Peter Jackson, right? Peter Jackson.
Like, yeah.
Big time documentarian, or not documentarian, filmmaker. And he.
Oh, wait, those are documentaries?
This is a documentary. Yeah, but those were not.
No, okay. Yeah,
didn't really happen with the ring and the
run
through. Yeah, no. But he was able to get archival clips. Apparently, he's a big World War One fanatic, which you realize because he does an interview after the thing where he's like, I just happen to have some like uniforms lying around and it's like a closet full of World War
One. Yeah, it's a little,
a tank. You're like, yeah, tanks? Okay.
Yeah.
But he got archival clips from Britain's Imperial War Museums and he, like, not just did they tell the story of World War One through the eyes of these soldiers, but they colorized all the footage. They matched the frame rate on all the footage to bring it to life because a lot of these were hand cranked. So the frame rates were all over the place. And so they had to like slow it down or speed it up to get it where it needed to be. And then they hired local actors from the regions where the individuals would have been from to do all the voice work.
Well, and they also hired like a lip reading expert, right? Because most of the films or most of the footage is silent.
Yeah,
and so they had someone so they had someone watch it and like figure out what they were saying and then had them play it. Yeah, it's incredible.
It's so great. And so like it's stunning to watch. And it's one of those things where
I've heard that it's kind of uncanny, like kind of like uncomfortable to watch. Did you feel that?
In certain scenes, it's a bit odd. Well, also part of that comes from the fact that apparently during World War One, when they had the sort of, I guess you would call them documentarians, but the embedded reporters with the soldiers didn't know what to do when they saw cameras rolling because they didn't live in our world. Like people weren't filming all the time. Only movies really filmed. And so they just kind of stare at the camera a lot. So it's odd. Like having lunch or they'll be like literally in the trenches on the line, like cleaning their guns. And they all are just staring at the lens, either laughing or frozen because they don't know what to do. And so that gives it kind of an interesting, weird quality because you're locking eyes with these guys a lot and they look really uncomfortable. Like, oh, I'm on camera. Ugh.
Totally. There's we're going to go totally down this rabbit hole because there's this great film called A Trip Down Market Street Before the Fire, which is from 1906. And it's this short film that was produced by the Miles brothers. And basically it's before the big fire in San Francisco, which I think the fire happened in 1909. Mm-hmm. And so this film is from 1906. And it's one of the very few pieces of footage or even photography of what San Francisco looked like before this huge fire that just like really just decimated the city. And so they're on a cable car and they put a camera on the front of a cable car and just sort of goes down Market Street. And it's similar. There's people can't figure out what to do. Like everyone's looking at the camera, but they're like, what is this? There's this guy, Rick Prelinger and his wife, actually, they run this archive called the Prelinger Archive and in San Francisco. And this past year, Rick got like a really good original version of this. And he actually restored it to like a really high quality. And so it used to be when you would watch this little clip, which you can find on the internet, it's like, you know, it's easy to find. It's called A Trip Down Market Street Before the Fire. But it was really, it felt super old timey, right? Like it was really hard to kind of see, like you could see what was going on, but you couldn't see people's faces really well. You couldn't see a ton of detail. And he actually
like
screened
when they're
it.
Grainy and they're also like, it's the wrong film speed.
Exactly.
It really messes
totally.
With you. It doesn't feel
totally.
Real.
Right. And like, it's also old, right? This is like film from like actual film from like 1906. Yeah. Right. And so it's degraded a little bit. And so he actually created a 4K scan of this footage and did a ton of restoration work and screened it this past year in San Francisco. And we went and saw it and it is incredible. You can see like license plate numbers. You can see all of this detail, all these people, but it's similar because a lot of people don't know what to do when they see the camera. The other cool thing about it is that this was before cars really like took over roads, right? Before the auto industry kind of like made their big push to say that like the road is only for cars and pedestrians who jaywalk or anybody who comes into the road is sort of on their own and they're responsible for their own danger that they've sort of put themselves in. And before they pushed for jaywalking laws and all that stuff. So the the road is like chaos, right? There's like carts and there's people and there's like people running and there's, it's just like, it's amazing. It's incredible. It's this incredible look at like what it was like in 1906, like the clothes and everyone's like faces. It just, I definitely recommend it. It's on archive.org. You can see it. It's amazing.
Oh, I love it. And I also love that, like, as we both said, we're like, we love rabbit holes. We've been talking for so long about old footage when, like, your podcast, right, Flash Forward, is all about the future.
Yes, it's true. It's true. It's true. Although I will say that, like, I often joke that, like, it's a show about the future, but, like, half of the show is about history because futurists hate history and, like, should pay more attention to it.
It's so true. Oh, my gosh. Like, how often do you feel that way when people are proselytizing or they're talking about kind of, like, you know, these dire things that are going to happen or these, like, ludicrous extremes that are going to exist within, like, 5 years, which is never the case. And it's like, have you not read things before?
Exactly. No, totally. It's like, you know that we like tried this, right? Like, you know, yeah, totally. It's incredible. And like, I mean, they will go out and flat out say, like, I don't care about history. History doesn't matter. Like, I mean, there are multiple like big name, you know, futurist or tech guys who have flat out said, like, I don't care about history. History is not interesting to me. History is not useful to me. And I'm a little bit like, whew, yikes. Wow. Like, that is also like how you wind up in really ethically fraught territory, is that you don't learn from history, right? Like, I mean, there's that, I don't remember who said it, but the like classic phrase, like, those who don't learn history are doomed to repeat it or whatever. I'm butchering. But yeah, I mean, so we do a lot of history on Flash Forward.
Good. That's so good. And when you say we...
I do the same thing that you do on the show, which is I say we. It's just me.
It's just you. That's what I thought. Just me. Yeah.
I feel like it sounds more official if I'm like, we, like I have a team. But it is so funny. Yeah, it's only me. I know you do this on the show, too. It'll be like, we, I mean, me, just me. It's just me right here in my room. Yeah, it is so funny. I get emails from people and I try to respond to like every email I get from listeners, you know, and sometimes people respond to me like, wow, like Rose responded to my email. And I'm like, oh, there's no one else here.
Yeah, if it's signed by somebody else, we made that person up.
Yeah, that's no. Or it's like my dog has learned how to type. It's like it's all there is.
I love it. Oh my gosh, I love it so much. So as of this recording, you have just started season five already. You're so smart for doing it in seasons.
I mean, they're like somewhat arbitrary, right? It's usually 20 episodes in a season, and then I just take a break because I get tired. Mm-hmm. And, like, making the show is a lot of work.
It makes it manageable. It makes it bingeable. Like, you know, for all those reasons, I think that it really does play into human psychology. Mine is just like never ending nonstop.
Yeah, like, oh, I do wonder, like, because it does feel like such a... I talked to Helen Zaltzman about this, actually. She does The Illusionist, and she's also on like a weekly schedule, and I just cannot imagine. I mean, even when Flash Forward is in season, it's every other week because there's just no way that I'm making that show every week.
That's just not happening. You make a show. Like, there are different ways to podcast. There are different time lengths. There are different editorial decisions that people make. There are different, you know, actual physical editing schedules, and you produce a podcast. Like, Talk Nerdy is not terribly produced. You know what I mean? I just kind of shoot the shit with somebody for an hour, and then I shoot the shit with somebody else. So it's sort of like a low bar, or at least that's how I set it up early on, because I was like, I know I'm not going to be able to do much more than this. But
you should not sell yourself short, because there are many people who are not very good at interviewing, and that these shows are terrible, and your show is actually good. So I just want to say, it is a skill to be able to just shoot the shit and have it be listenable.
I guess, you know... There is something to that, because I think what we try to do is, you know, it's something we learn early on with SciComm. It's like, let's lean into our strengths, right? Like, why do something and take on something that's like painful, that we're not all that good at to begin with, and that's going to cause all sorts of strife and stress. And yeah, we take on stress with our work, but, you know, it's kind of why I don't write that much, because I don't really enjoy writing. And I learned that early on. I'd much rather work on scripts. I'd much rather do on-camera stuff or talk off the cuff. Like, when I give talks, usually they're only loosely prepared, because if I script everything, I feel very burdened by trying to remember what comes next. And that's super stressful for me. But other people, the idea of going out there with no script is like horrifying.
Yeah.
So you're right. I think we, to each their own. But I definitely do, you know, see your finished product. Or we mentioned earlier our mutual friend, Allie Ward. And I see the work that she does on Ologies. And I'm like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do this kind of work. So hats off to you, because it is incredible. So why don't you, I know there's so much crossover. So a lot of people listening are like, I love Flash Forward. I already listened to it. But for the Talk Nerdy listeners who don't already listen to Flash Forward, why don't you talk us through, like you said, about 20 episodes a season. We're starting here on season 5, mostly about the future, but with a lot of recognition or hat tips to the past. But how does an episode come together, and what can people expect when they listen to it?
Yeah. So, you know, I say Flash Forward is a podcast about the future. Every episode is a different future. Some of them are likely, you know, we do things like what happens when antibiotics stop working because antibiotic resistance has gotten really bad. And like, that's one of the more terrifying ones. But we also do things, or I also do things that are, I guess, on the other end of the plausibility spectrum. So we'll do things like, what happens if space pirates drag a second moon to Earth and the Earth suddenly has two moons? And that one is fun because it's sort of like, what does the Earth's moon do for Earth? Like, what is that? What impact does that have? And then I also talked to some folks who help design rockets. Like, how do you design a spaceship to try to capture a moon-sized object? And that's something that, you know, people who are thinking about asteroid mining actually have to think about. So it's kind of like using those weirdo hypotheticals to kind of get at some of the science that's really cool behind that. I don't always do, it's not all science futures. Some of them are more social. We've done an episode about universal basic income. I did an episode last season about what would happen if the U.S. Census failed. So the U.S. Census is happening in 2020, and it's, as people might have already seen in the news, kind of fraught right now. The budget has been cut. They haven't really been able to do a lot of the field tests that they need to do. They're also debating these sort of citizenship question that will probably vastly decrease the number of people who answer this the census. And so if the census kind of fails in that it doesn't actually capture an accurate picture of the United States, like, what does that actually mean? It has some really huge impacts on services and on the ways that, you know, money is distributed and all that stuff. I did an episode about what would happen if we lived in a future where, like, no, just nobody cared about gender. Like, it was just like hair color where it's like, oh yeah, she's blonde, but like, whatever. Yeah. And so, you know, I do things like that also. So it's sort of a mixture of sort of science and tech futures and then sort of more cultural, social, historical futures. This season is season 5. This year I'm doing it a little bit differently. So it used to be that it was just sort of a random future every other week and you never really knew what you were going to get. This year I'm doing it slightly differently. There are little mini seasons within this season. So yesterday or last week was the first episode of an Earth mini season. Mm-hmm. So there's 5 episodes in that one. The first one was about geoengineering. So should we spray sulfur aerosols into the atmosphere to cool the planet? Sort of like what the arguments for and against that are. And also sort of questions about like, why is it that we don't have actual sort of engineering tests about this thing that has actually been proposed since the 1960s. And yet we still like don't really know how it would work on the ground and why that is. And then the episode that's coming out this week, I don't know when this episode of Talk Nerdy comes out, but the episode that's going out on Tuesday, the 12th, is about what would happen if the Earth's poles reverse. So if north is south and south is north, which is a really fun
right
one.
Right now. Wait, aren't they all
they are wandery. Yeah, they are wandery right now.
Are they reversed already though?
So
is north actually south?
Technically, yes.
Okay. So they reversed again.
Yeah. So they've reversed a bunch of times over the Earth's history. And it's sort of about like, A, the guy who discovered that is actually totally forgotten in scientific history. Sort of like how he discovered that, but also what it would be like.
That discovery is kind of forgotten by like everyday people.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that most people have no idea that like that can happen. And right now the Earth is like the North Pole is sort of wandering very quickly away from Canada and towards Siberia. Mm. And they actually had to reissue the sort of global magnetic map, the official magnetic field map of the Earth. They usually come out every 5 years and they had to re-release it this year. It's supposed to come out next year because it was so inaccurate that they were like, this is actually like messing up navigational systems. This is not, we can't have it. So the weird thing about that is that I learned in reporting this is I kept asking people like, how would we know if we were at the beginning of one of these reversals? And there's no way to know. Like we have no idea. Like we don't know. There's no like checklist where it's like, okay, if these things like happen, then we're definitely at the beginning of a reversal. And because they happen over such long timescales, you probably won't know what's happening until it's kind of like already happening. You know what I mean?
Like it's like aging, but even more intense than aging.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I always joke, what would happen if like on the morning of your birthday, you looked in the mirror and you aged that entire year? Like,
oh my God, that'd be
seconds.
Terrifying.
It'd be terrifying. You'd see it. Like you'd be like, I'm older. But
totally.
It happens so slowly, we don't know.
You're just like, whatever. Yeah. And it's like the boiling frog thing, right? Where it like slowly happens and then like eventually you're like, oh yeah, right. So that's that one. And then there's 3 more after that, including things like, you know, what would happen if we tried to completely ban cement. Cement accounts for maybe about 10% of man-made CO2 emissions. Mm-hmm. And so like, what would it look like if we tried to stop using it? And it's like impossible, basically,
because
we
did everything. It would fall apart.
Right.
Did you talk to Vince Beiser for that episode?
No, I didn't.
I had him on the show maybe a couple months ago, and he wrote a book, not about cement, but about sand, which is like a central component of cement.
Yeah.
And the whole book is about how sand is like this resource that we're actually starting to run out of. And there's like, you know, all sorts of like black market for sand, and people died for sand. It's like amazing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, actually, there's another episode in this little mini season that's about the deserts and about the deserts kind of like getting bigger. So the Sahara has gotten about 10% bigger in the last century, which is not good. And so like, what happens if we live in like a dune planet where there's just like sand everywhere, stuff like that. So yeah, so it's sort of those ideas. And so that's that season. And then the next one is five episodes about bodies that are all, each episode is a different like kind of body related feature. So I'm kind of playing around with the format right now. We'll see if it works. I don't know. It's kind of fun for me, because each episode starts with a little sort of like audio drama fiction piece, which is very fun for me to write. And on this, these mini seasons, so normally they're just random, like the futures, there's sort of these random intro sketches. And for this season, all of the sketches are actually connected to one another. So there's like recurring characters, and there's like an arc of these people who are kind of like learning about the world. And so that's been really fun to write. And so I'm excited to see how that unfolds. And if listeners are into it, it's been really, really fun for me.
Yeah. Because I think when we think about podcasts, most podcasts, not the ones like the Serial-esque podcast, but most podcasts really are standalone, right? Unless it's like a narrative nonfiction or even a narrative fiction where it's like they build on each other. Most podcasts, you can kind of pick and choose. Oh, I like that topic, or oh, I'm not as busy today, or whatever. But the funny thing is people still listen to them serially. I think generally speaking, people are like, oh, new episode, I'll listen. And the fact that we don't thread them together is sort of a missed opportunity. I mean, for me, I can't imagine how I would, but like, it's cool that you're playing with that format, because I think that that'll really speak to a lot of people.
I hope so. It's really fun for me. Like these intro sketches, they're really short. They're like, 5 minutes at the top of every episode. And most of the episode is sort of like reporting and journalism where I like talk to a bunch of people and, edit it all together. But the intro scenes are really fun to write. Just because, getting to write a little bit of fiction based on a bunch of reporting is really a joy, because you get to kind of like play with the ideas that you've learned. And I'm like a huge sci-fi nerd, so being able to kind of like dig into that has been really fun. I think that like, it is funny. I'm curious what you think about this, because every time people say like, oh, I just learned about Flash Forward and I just started listening from the first ever episode, and I'm always like, oh no, could you work backwards? Because they definitely get better. Like the first episodes are like not very good.
I feel the same way. I'm always like, why would you start with the crappy ones when nobody was listening?
I know. And I'm like, no, please begin, like work backwards. It's fine. Yeah. You don't need to start from the beginning. And like, yeah. So I'm always like, oh no, I wonder how many people like listen to the first couple and are like, who is this woman? Like, what is going on here?
Oh gosh, I literally think that everyone feels that way, and they feel that way. Whether it's a blogger, whether it's a YouTuber, whether it's, everybody, when you talk to them, they're like, oh, I sucked at the beginning.
Yeah,
like,
you have to try. Yeah.
Watch them. They're
100%. Yeah, no, I actually went back and I'm thinking about doing a little mini season for Patreon subscribers that is just like revisiting episodes we've done in the past. So this show's been on for a while, and like things have changed, right, in some of these topics. I mean, there's a couple that have changed a lot. Facial recognition, I did like years ago, and obviously facial recognition has gotten much more interesting and much different. And so I was thinking about redoing a couple of episodes. So I went back and listened to a couple from the first season, and I was like, oh God, it was so painful.
I love that. But that's the great thing about podcasting, is that hopefully the people who are going back to start at the beginning are podcast listeners, tours, right? They're people who like don't just listen to one podcast. They listen to tons of podcasts, and they're like, oh yeah, I know the drill. It's like pilots. Like, yeah, the pilot always sucks.
Totally. And I hope that, and I think that, like, putting yourself, if you wait until you're, like, going to be good at it, you'll just never start. So it's not like I wish I hadn't put those out. I'm very glad that I started, and I'm glad that, like, that exists. And I do hope that listeners who listen through to, like, I mean, I just got some emails recently today from some people who were like, I just binged the whole, like, you know, show because, you know, whatever. I just finished. I'm so excited it's back. And I hope that they, like, appreciate the progression too, where they can hear that, like, I get more confident and, like, the show gets better. Like, you know, things are more interesting. And I think that, like, that's kind of a cool thing about following a show or a blog or even someone on, like, Instagram for a long time is that you get to see them get better, which is, like, a joy, right? I love watching people that I admire get better at stuff.
All right, everyone. I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode. And let's start with Mova. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to be partnering with Mova because you've got to get one of these if you don't already have one. My Mova globe is like my favorite thing in my office. These are rotating globes that are actually powered by light. They turn on when they're exposed to just ambient light, so they don't have to be in direct sunlight. The lights can actually be kind of low in your room. And there are these hidden magnets that provide movement. So no batteries, no cords. It's kind of like magic, but it's not magic. Because it's science. They're so, so, so cool. And they're beautiful. They're available in over 40 different designs. A lot of world maps. My favorite, of course, are the outer space globes, but they're also famous artwork. I think the reason that I love the outer space globes the most is because they're true to life. They feature really high resolution graphics that were provided by NASA and JPL. And there's all sorts of options. There are different planets. I have a Mars globe that I absolutely love. That there's a stunning Jupiter globe, a stunning, ooh, there's a new Pluto globe that has the new high-res information on it. I mean, like, oh my gosh, you can see things that we didn't even know existed when we were kids. It's really cool. Moons, not just our moon, but also the moons of Jupiter. There are a lot of really cool ones. Asteroids even, and even constellation designs. They're so cool. You can read all about how they actually work online, but I would just recommend going to the website, clicking through all of the stunning different globes like Titan, right? Saturn's moon. They work directly with a member of the Cassini mission to create that design. And it's so beautiful. I think now I'm going to have to get one of these, but you could get one too. All you've got to do is go to www.movaglobes.com/nerdy. It's that easy. movaglobes.com/nerdy. Nerdy, but you've got to use the coupon code nerdy and you'll get 10% off your purchase. Once again, that's www.movaglobes.com/nerdy and use the coupon code nerdy for 10% off. I also want to thank Sora Lighting for their support of the show. This is the light that designers trust because, of course, the LEDs are beautiful. So let's talk a little bit about Sora Radiant, which are the lights that I have. Sora Radiant is uniquely designed with full spectrum technology. So you see every color the same way you see them outside. As you know, sometimes you go into people's houses and the light is like too yellow or it's too blue. But with Sora Radiant, you really do see colors as the sun makes them look. But there's also a really cool product that Sora is offering right now called Sora Healthy. It's the only LED designed with zero blue light. And so it really does help you with sleep because I'm not going to get too heavy into it. But as you guys know, there's a portion of the brain that is affected by light. And when light strikes, it's actually called your suprachiasmatic nucleus. It actually tells your brain to stop producing melatonin. And that's why when we stay up late on our computers or we're surrounded by artificial light that has a lot of blue in it, we tend to suppress our natural melatonin production. And we sometimes have a hard time going to sleep at night. You know, different strokes for different folks. But for some people, it really does affect them heavily. So if we don't have that blue wavelength around us, especially late at night, maybe we're going to be able to produce more melatonin and be able to sleep well. And Sora Healthy is going to help you with that. So I highly recommend that you check out Sora Healthy, Sora Radiant. There are so many different options and you can have stunning, stunning light within your own home. Okay, so all you've got to do is head on over to amazon.com/Sora. That's amazon.com/SORA. AA. You enter the promo code NERDYLIGHT at checkout and you'll get 15% off any purchase over $50. So again, 15% off any purchase over $50. You just got to go to amazon.com/Sora, S-O-R-A-A, and enter the promo code NERDYLIGHT at checkout. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I think it's so cool too, because like the way that you iterate specifically, and not everybody has this opportunity, is that you listen to your listeners. And so like, I've even seen that there are, you know, episodes where you're like, this is the most requested episode. Like by far, people ask for this topic the most. So I decided to do it, which is like, that's great to have that feedback loop, that iterative quality where it's like, no, I'm definitely listening to you and I want to give you what you want.
Yeah, I think so. One of the sort of things I think a lot about with Flash Forward is that the show is really trying to be kind of an answer or even sort of a pushback to so much of what is out there in terms of futurism coverage. Mm-hmm. I think that there's so much coverage of futurism and of the future, but it's often so sort of like monolithic and so homogenous. It's like a bunch of white guys talking about how cool technology is,
talking,
you know,
about the singularity.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that like Flash Forward, even from the very beginning, you know, one of my big goals was to like bring more people into the conversation about the future, right? That like, you know, that's why when we did that episode about UBI, Universal Basic Income, which is a really hot topic among people in the tech world right now, in part because they're sort of trying to answer this question of what happens when robots take everybody's jobs. You know, they want to have an answer to that. But for that episode, I didn't talk to tech people. What I talked to were people who are working on sort of like social justice initiatives that are, you know, basic income focused. So people who, so there's this really great project in Jackson, Mississippi, and they are, they don't care. I asked her, I was like, do you ever think about robots and whatever? And she was like, no, I'm just trying to help the like single moms in my community, like live, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think that for Flash Forward, a big thing I think a lot about is bringing more people into this conversation about the future. And I'm very public and, you know, I write on the blog for the show about like making sure that the show has diverse voices and, you know, making sure that there's a gender balance and a racial balance in the voices that you hear so that it's not just the same six white guys talking about the future every episode. And that's super important to me. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from listeners who have said things like, you know, I didn't think I cared about science or technology, or I didn't think I cared about the future, but like this show, I like this show because it like shows that I am actually part of this, right? That I can make a difference and that the future is something that we're all shaping together, right? Like obviously some people have more power than other people, like in terms of capital and influence, but the future is kind of moldable by everybody and should include more voices. And so I get emails from people who are very thankful for that. So I try to listen to those people when they say like, hey, I want to know about this, because that's kind of the thing that is important to me in the show, is like giving people context for when they see headlines, right? When they see that like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg are like arguing about, you know, AI, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? Am I allowed to curse on this show?
Totes.
Great.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay. And they like see these headlines and they're like, I don't know what the fuck any of this means. Like, I don't, like, what is this? How does this relate to me? And so like trying to kind of give people answers, or at least equip them with the kinds of questions they can ask when they see headlines like that, or to be like, okay, but like who wins in this situation? Like who are these people? You know, what, give me the context here. And so that's kind of really important to me. So, you know, when we do things that are requested, I try to kind of take them from interesting angles. So one episode that was requested a ton and I put off for so long because I like personally just am not interested in it or wasn't, which is Living Forever.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, it's just this like pipe dream that like so many white guys are really obsessed with.
My whole take on that anytime we argue about it on the SGU is basically that like, I really think that the guys who desperately want to live forever need a lot of therapy.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Facing mortality. We actually call it mortality salience. It's a construct in psychology that like facing your own mortality has like major, like positive psychological outcomes.
Yeah.
And just avoiding it is not healthy, you guys.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think like it's Madeline Ashby, who's a really great futurist, has this really funny line that I steal from her all the time, which is that like, oh yeah, living forever sounds great when you're making compound interest, right? Like it's only for people who like have this kind of like cush life, right? And most people are like, no, thank you. But so it was requested a lot. And I was like, how am I going to do this? Like, I, again, like, I don't really like buy into this as a concept in general, you know what I mean? And so what we wound up doing was, looking at it from the perspective of criminal justice. And so like, what happens when you can incarcerate someone for 300 years? Like, how does that look? And what does that look like? And like, you know, we already have such an unjust system and what happens when that's like multiplied by, you know, what happens when a lifetime sentence for somebody who like stole a backpack or whatever it is, or didn't actually was wrongfully mm-hmm. convicted. What happens when that's 300 years instead of, you know, 97, which is already like so much time. Yeah. And you know, like, what does it look like when someone gets out of prison after 300 years? And like the 300 years of technology has happened and they're trying to kind of like catch
Futurama.
Up. Right, exactly.
Like, it's like exactly what happened to Fry, you know?
Right,
like, that's
exactly.
not the world we want to live in.
Right, right. And so like that's kind of, so if there is one like that where people ask a lot for it, you know, I often will take those kinds of angles to be like, okay, well, let's interrogate like why this is an interesting question to people. You know, we did one about food pills, right? Food pills, like this future where we'll eat food and these pills, and kind of digging into like the sociology of that. And like, why is it that like Soylent is a thing that certain kinds of people think is like an ideal food. And in many parts of the world, that's not the case. And part of it has to do with this question of like, is time money?
Yeah.
And if time is money, then yeah, like eating is worthless. But if time isn't money and you can actually like live and relax and like enjoy things, then maybe food bills aren't appealing. So that's the kind of stuff that we do, is like kind of trying to take on some of these futures that people request, but also giving maybe a surprising angle or a surprising way into it, so that at least, I mean, also like part of it is, you know, if I'm going to work this hard on a show, I want to be interested in the episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah, but some of it is just me being like, and there are a couple that I haven't figured out how to do. Like one that gets requested a lot is driverless cars. And I just feel like there's so much coverage of driverless cars. Like, I don't know what Flash Forward is going to be able to add to that conversation.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so like, you know, a lot of the time, If there are things that we don't do that get requested a lot, it's because I'm just like, I just don't know. Like, you can read about this. Like, there's so many people covering this. There's so many smart people covering, like, the fact that this is not going to happen the way that people think it's going to happen, or the way that all these CEOs claim it's going to happen. I don't know that I can add much to it on my side. So that's when we don't do the ones that people recommend. But yeah, I love recommendations. It's like one of the best parts. People come up with weird shit. It's so good.
It's so, I mean, it just speaks to why it is so important to have like a diversity of voices, right? Whether it's within the boardroom or whether it's just like the fans of a podcast, because they come up with stuff that we wouldn't come up with because they have different lives than we do.
Yeah. No, people will send me emails and I'm just like, damn, that's like, how did you think of that?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. Oh. Yeah. I love it.
And you know what I think is so great is because of your perspective, which like cares deeply about things like social justice, cares deeply about things like sociology, like history, not just this sort of, and like you said yourself that you're a huge sci-fi fan, but you don't just have this like pure what we think of as modern sci-fi sensibility. You have, I think, more of like a vintage sci-fi sensibility, which really is concerned about these kind of very humanistic themes. You know, that's why the type of sci-fi that I still can only really read is that sort of mid-century sci-fi that has that very kind of, I don't know, like conscientious vibe to it. That's why when science fiction movies that feel like, I don't know, to me it all blurs with science fiction and comic books. And so, you know, superhero movies and movies that are like just pure action movies don't speak to me nearly as much as movies like, what did they change the name of the book to be? Arrival. Like, that's one of my favorite modern sci-fi movies.
I love that movie. Yeah, yeah. Or like, I don't know if you saw Annihilation. I loved that.
I haven't seen it yet. Should I see it?
I love the, I don't know how you feel about the book. So the, it's a 3-part series by Jeff Vandermeer. And, in my opinion, the first book is like one of the greatest sci-fi books that I've read in a long time. It's really short. I mean, it's like 120 pages, I think. It's all from the perspective of a woman biologist. Mm-hmm. And it's just got this, like, Jeff is so good at creating a vibe. Like, just the whole book is just like you're in this weird place and everything feels like beautiful but also terrifying and very, very strange and like off in this way that you can't quite understand. He's just so good at that thing. Mm-hmm. It's like almost horror but it's not quite horror, and he has this like really vivid way of describing it, and she's a really interesting character. And so the first book is to me like one of this, like, just I reread it sometimes. It's so good. I love it. It is a trilogy. The other two, like, it sort of depends on how much you care about answers.
Okay. Yeah.
And so like, I personally like don't really care that much about like, but what's happening here? You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, I'm fine with like, oh, this is like just a cool vibe kind of book. Uh-huh. But if you want to know like what the fuck is going on, the next two books actually try to answer it. But I found that they were a little bit more like they were a little more dense and like hard to get through because it was like there's a lot of like explanation that has to happen for like what is going on. Gotcha, and like what, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So it becomes like dogma. Like those are the things I don't like about Tolkien. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's yeah, it's not much. Like that. It's not yeah. that bad. Like there okay, aren't like whole good. Sections that are just like, I mean, it's not like in the 1984 where there's like a whole chapter that's just like a chapter from a textbook, like a yeah. political scientist. And I'm like, I don't care. Which is so bad to admit, but like, yeah, I just like skip that every time. I'm like, I'm skipping this chapter. But yeah, like, so there are still characters, but like the first book to me is just like, oh, so perfect. And the movie is really interesting. It's very different from the books, but mm-hmm. it does kind of capture that like beautiful horror of this place. And like, I have my qualms with the movie, but I do think it's beautiful, right? Like it's shot really beautifully. The scenes are really beautiful. It has sort of some really interesting ideas in it. But yeah, the books are definitely, I would recommend the books if you're into like, it's not like sci-fi in the like robots and kind of like spaceship sci-fi, which is, you know, I don't tend to like space opera kind of sci-fi.
Yeah, me neither. Because it's not really even sci-fi. That's the thing. Yeah. Like people talk about Star Wars like it's sci-fi and I'm like, that's fantasy. Yeah,
this is a political commentary.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is like a good and evil, like religious allegory. Yeah, like, it's not.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm definitely, I mean, like Arrival is amazing. That short story and that collection of short stories that comes from is really great. Yeah, there's some really cool, there's a book actually that just came out called Infinite Detail by Tim Mann, which is a sci-fi book that is very much concerned with like the human ramifications of like technology, and oh, cool. it's great.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, I definitely am on the same page where like all the like Heinlein, like golden age of sci-fi stuff, I'm a little bit like, meh.
Yeah, no, but more like the Ex Machina, the kind of Black Mirror-y thing. I mean, do you remember when we first stumbled upon Black Mirror? Like before it was on Netflix, I remember watching it on Audience Channel on DirecTV and being like, what is this amazing? Charlie Brooker is a genius. And, you know, you see the differences even within Black Mirror episodes. It's funny. It almost mirrors what you said about the trilogy, that like there's some episodes that are like denser with information. They're like not as interesting to me. And then there are other episodes that are just really vibey and they never really fully explain it, but you're like, oh my gosh, it's like dystopian, but it's like near future and it's creepy, but not quite horror.
Yeah.
And you're just uncomfortable the whole time. Like it really does that well.
Yeah. I love the ones that are more of like a feeling than maybe an explanation. And this is like a thing I get into trouble with all the time. Cause like I write a little bit of fiction and I have this little writing group and they're like, you know, in Lost where like it's smoke monsters where it's like, who knows what's happening? Like no one has any idea what's going on. And I'm definitely on that end of things where I'm like, I don't care about the explanation. Like it doesn't matter to me, like why something is happening. Like as long as you're like, as long as you buy into the world, I'm like kind of, I don't really care that much. And so I definitely get people in the writing group who are like, no, but like, what's going on? And I'm like, okay, but that's not the point.
Sometimes your own imagination is going to fill that in so much better. Like, did you ever see the Stephen King movie version of The Mist?
No.
Okay. So this is like arguably one of the worst movies ever made.
Could also be
considered one of the most genius movies ever made. And I don't want to give away the ending because it's honestly one of the best endings of a film I think I've ever seen. Even though it's a garbage movie, the end is like shockingly amazing. But the thing about The Mist is that there's like something happening in the mist and nobody can go outside because the mist will take them or eat them or whatever. And it's like such a genius but very simple concept. But in the film, of course, they have to like show the fucking mist monsters. And then you're like, ugh. So they have
It ruins it, right? Because like, I mean, often those books, those sci-fi books or horror books where it's like, there's something out there, like, it doesn't matter what it is. It's all about your imagination. Like the whole point of the story is that like, we can imagine what we imagine is always worse than what it actually is. Right. And like this, our ability to like project into the mist, like all of our fears is that's like the point of it, you know? Like, and so, yeah, I do find that like when you have to like lay it out where it's like, well, actually it's this, like, and you're like, it's really spores in the air from a fungus. And you're like, okay, but like that ruins it for me.
Oh, there's even a scene, literally a scene in The Mist where they're in the grocery store and they're like, why could this happen? And somebody pipes up and they're like, well, in the 1980s there was this lab that, and it's like all exposition for like 30 straight seconds and you're like, but why?
Right, and that character like never shows back up. It's like literally just their only job is to like pop up and be like, let me explain.
That's so stupid.
I mean, I do agree that like the Black Mirror episodes that like I find are the most interesting are the ones that are like paintings, right, where it's like a brush of this thing and to make you think about it. And the ones that like I find a little harder are the ones where it's like, what if technology, but too much, and let me explain why. And you're like, okay, I get it though.
I still like San Junipero the best, and everybody hates me for it, but I don't
care. No, I love that one.
It's so good. It's so,
that's the one I always recommend for people to start with.
Yeah. Well, it's an easy way in because, you know, if you start, the first episode you'll see is Pigfucker, and it might turn you off.
It's so funny you say that because I actually, advertised for Black Mirror on Flash Forward. They bought an ad on the show. And
awesome.
Which is cool. And so I said in the ad, I was like, okay, I do my little ad read or whatever. And I got a text from a friend of mine being like, what the fuck? Because he went and watched the first episode. And if I am in conversation with someone and I recommend Black Mirror, I'm like, okay, just don't start with the first one. I always say that.
Because
I'm like,
do it later, but
don't start with the first one. But I can't say that in an ad. You know what I mean? Where they're paying me money to advertise this thing. And so I just whatever. And he texts me, he's like, what the fuck did you just ask me to watch? It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, no, you start with the white bear one. Was
you cannot.
Or whatever. That one's really
good. Would love to be a fly on the wall in that room where they were like, no, we're starting with the pig fucking. You know what I mean? Like, who made that decision?
I know. Probably Charlie Brooker.
Probably. Netflix was totally.
And he was like, do you want this deal or not?
Yeah, totally. I know, but I just love that they're like, oh no, we are going to start with this one. Yeah, because it's it truly is a bold choice.
Very bold. Yeah. Oh my gosh, so true. So I mean, I'm so excited that your kind of sensibility and your focus does have a bit of, and maybe I'm using a dirty word here and you can tell me if you see yourself as this or not, but has a little bit of an activist-y vibe in it. You have a point of view at least, and you care about social justice, you care about diversity, you care about equity, you care about a lot of the societal ills that when we think of a future society that's functional, we hope that we're going to solve a lot of the problems of today. So it's like technology is not a panacea. People have to make moral decisions, and there has to be regulation, and they have to, utilize ethics, and they have to be focused on things like equality of opportunity. And a lot of people don't want to talk about that shit when they talk about the future. They just want to talk about cool machines solving the world, which is a ludicrous proposition. So do you see yourself as a kind of under the radar activist?
I don't think I would use, I see myself as a journalist. I think that they're there's the idea that journalism is objective is bullshit, which many people have written about and talked about before. I do think that when you cover the future, you are willfully ignorant if you think that it isn't inherently political, because any future that you pitch as good or bad means that you're putting a value judgment on it, right? Yeah. And that is an inherently political decision to do. So I think that pretending that the future is apolitical is absurd. And also, means that you're basically lying to people. Because this idea that I think what I try to push back on a little bit is the idea that the future is sort of unavoidable and inherent, right? That we're on this track and we can't get off this track. This is just how it's going to be. And that's kind of a future that I think tech people, and not just tech people, but billionaires would love for you to believe, because it means that they convince you that you can't actually do anything to change what's going on, and that you just let technology take its course, its natural course, whatever that means, which is not a thing. That doesn't make any sense. I interviewed a person who runs a technology startup that is selling facial recognition systems to schools to use with students. And I kind of was asking him how do students feel about that? Do they like it? Do they feel creeped out by the fact that their computers in school are now watching their faces and scanning their faces all the time? And he said, he was like, oh yeah, no, they hate it. They hate it. They feel like they're being watched all the time. And I'm like, okay, right. Fair enough. I would also not like that. And I was like, what do you say to them when they, ask you these questions or say these things? And he said, he literally said, he was like, well, you can't go against the natural evolution of technology. And I was like, that's not a thing. It's 100% not a thing. Everything that we do is a choice, right? Everything you've chosen to develop this technology and to sell it to schools, right? Yeah. And you can say, oh, well, if I don't do it, someone else will. But that's not an argument you can really make, because you have chosen, you have made this choice to do this. So from my perspective, as a person who makes a lot of stuff about the future, it sort of is foolish to pretend as though this is an apolitical thing. Even if you say all I want to know is about how cool technology is. That's a value judgment, right? You're saying technology is inherently cool and there are no downsides is a political statement. Mm-hmm. It is a statement about how you feel about sort of the people running technology, that they have your best interest in mind. And maybe they do. I think they do have the best interest of some people in mind. Those people don't happen to be me or yeah. a lot of my friends, but like for some number of people, the folks who are running Silicon Valley, the folks who are sort of putting out all these technologies do have their best interest in mind. But that means that they are like politicians, they have constituents, right? They have people for whom they are representing, or they have people who they are representing, and they have people who they're not representing. Mm-hmm. Whether that's willfully or not, it doesn't really matter. And so I think that like pretending as though the future is this sort of, you know, amorphous, apolitical, sort of like magical thing in the future would be, I think, malpractice, like journalistic malpractice to do.
Yeah.
And so I don't do that. I'm very, very upfront about that on the show. I'm very upfront about like where I come from, and about like what the point of view of the show is. I think it's a relatively, I would hope, uncontroversial view of the future, which is that mm-hmm. it should be good for everybody, which I would hope people like,
yeah,
you know, are
surprised.
Down with.
Yeah.
No, right. Of course that's not true. But I do get pushback, right? I do get pushback when I include voices that maybe push against the dominant narrative about what technology is for and what it's doing. So mm-hmm. for example, I did an episode about exoskeletons. And this, like, there's a certain group of people who are very excited about exoskeletons for a couple of different reasons. Some of them are excited about them for military applications. Some of them are excited about them sort of for workers in like an Amazon warehouse factory where they could like, you know, work more and be stronger, which like is its own sort of
yep.
capitalistic narrative, which uh-huh. I think is worth thinking about. But also there's a third sort of arm of that, which is people who are really excited about exoskeletons for folks who use wheelchairs, who are disabled, mm-hmm. And maybe who don't walk upright. And on the episode, I interviewed people who use wheelchairs about like why it is that this idea that we must walk on two legs is like so important to mostly able-bodied people. But yeah. when you ask people who use wheelchairs, they're like, "No, I'm good. Like my wheelchair is actually pretty sweet, and like I can go much faster than you can on your yeah. two legs." You know, and what they really want is like, you just install some fucking ramps. You know what I mean? Like they don't want yeah. the like $30,000 machine. They want like a $20 ramp, you know?
Yeah.
And so when you start doing stuff like that, where you include people into these visions of the future that seem apolitical, right? Where people will pitch like, "Oh, and then we're going to give an exoskeleton to every disabled person. They're going to walk like normal people," and like, yay, cue applause, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then when you actually talk to disabled people, they're like, "I don't want that."
Yeah, like, that's like, not, I think it's pretty normal that I'm in a wheelchair, but thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like, and I got emails from people who are like, "Well, I don't understand how anybody could want to be in a wheelchair." And it's like, so there's pushing back against that kind of techno utopian vision that like is driven by sort of able-bodied, usually mm-hmm. white, usually cis, usually straight, usually men. It does annoy people, but I think it's really important because, it's not like disabled people are going anywhere. Like they're not going to like disappear. You're not going to like CRISPR them out of existence, right?
Yeah. I would hope. I think some people have that kind of
100%, yeah,
eugenic utopia uh-huh. that they've.
Well, on the CRISPR episode, we actually talk about that, where I mm-hmm. interview this woman, Alice Wong, who runs a really cool project called Disability Visibility, and she talks about what it's like as a disabled person to watch all of these people talk about the future and talk about genetic engineering and genetic editing and talk about like, it's going to be so great when people like you don't exist and like what that's like, you know? And so I think it's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And they think it's like, they think they're pitching a utopia. Right. And so like this idea that like utopias aren't utopias for everybody. And what you pitch as utopia is inherently a political pitch that you're making. And so like trying to uncover that is important to me.
Yeah. I mean, again, speaking of, this just reminded me of the American Experience I watched just a few days ago before I watched the one about the flu of 1918 is called the Eugenics Crusade. And
yeah.
it's so, not the Eugenics Crew Crusade, but the Eugenics Crusade. And it's so stunning. I mean, it's kind of long, or maybe it's not that long. I can't remember if it's an hour or 2 hours, but no, it's 2 hours because it's got different chapters, I think. But part of the reason that it's so good is that they really do paint a picture of the social
yeah.
vibe when eugenics was at its, you know, peak, kind of moving into World War II in America, that, you know, that Hitler actually referenced American eugenics programs mm-hmm. in Mein Kampf because he saw that as the trend that they should go on. Of course, that was obviously unfettered and you know, went to a place that everybody in America, like, systematically denounced, not everybody, but most everybody denounced, and it sort of died off after we figured out what was actually going on in the camps in World War II. But prior to that, for decades, it really was sold as this, like, utopian society, and sort of everybody was on board, even though they never stopped to think, like, utopian for whom?
Totally. Right. And this brings us back to, like, what we talked about at the beginning, which is why history is so important to flash forward, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, if you play tape of some of these folks who are so excited about CRISPR to be able to, you know, eliminate disability, it's not that different from what they were saying, right? It's like, you sound exactly the same. And if people don't look at that history and don't listen to that and don't, like, read what those people were writing and note that they're so similar, mm-hmm. then that's, I mean, again, like, that's how you repeat yourselves.
And,
like,
absolutely.
Part of me is like, y'all, we've been down this road. Like, we did this. It did not go well mm-hmm. for lots of people. Like, let's not do this again. I thought we had already kind of, like, talked about this.
And not only did we do it, like, and it didn't go well, there, you know, other, obviously, nations, and maybe that's what you mean when you say we, like, really did it, like, they did it to the final solution, and we saw what happened. And, like, how can people literally, because I don't think these are Holocaust deniers. I think that they're literally just people who just don't see that it's the same thing.
I think it's also, so I got a lot of push, or not a lot. I got a couple of comments on that CRISPR episode where, when I sort of talked about the connection to eugenics. And I think that a lot of people don't know any disabled people, or don't think they know any disabled people.
Well, because societally, we don't prioritize having people with low intelligence, having people with physical disability, like, they're hidden.
I think that's also it. And also, I mean, there's a lot of invisible disabilities, right? That
that's
people, I think, like, most people probably, in fact, in the same way that, like, most people probably know a gay person or a queer person, most people probably actually do know a disabled person. But I think even for folks who do know a disabled person, there is this really strong assumption that they know what's best for that person. That there's this very strong paternalism that, like, oh, well, you must be miserable, and you must wish that you didn't have this. And you must, I mean, some people will say outright to disabled folks, like, I can't imagine living like you. Like, if I lived like you, I would kill myself.
That's
like,
I know, horrible thing to say.
Totally. I have friends who, like, have been told to their faces by people, like, in grocery stores, that, like, if I lived like you, I would kill myself.
Yeah,
which is like, who the fuck says that? Like,
I know.
But yeah, so I think that there is this, and this is a sort of, you know, all goes back to the social model of disability, which is a whole other conversation we can have, which is this idea that, like, people aren't necessarily disabled medically, they're disabled by society because society doesn't make space for them. And that is totally true for a lot of people. And so, you know, you have this question of, you know, if we live in a society that refuses to make space for these people, and in fact cares so much about these people going away that they're willing to, like, spend billions of dollars on medical research to try to genetically engineer them out of existence, like, what does that do to, like, the mental health of those people who exist and who live? And there's no way you're going to get rid of disability. That's, like, not a thing. Like, no one can do that.
And the truth is, you're right. Like, literature, like, review after review show that substance abuse is significantly higher in the disabled population, that mental illness is significantly higher. But it's not because those things are comorbid. It's because we live in a sick society. And that society itself is basically othering people on such a regular basis that, like, they can't help but feel second class, which is, like, so shit. And I think such a great example of that, and one that is probably a better, you know, a good bridge example for a lot of people, is the deaf community.
Right.
And, like, it's so hard for people to understand why somebody wouldn't give their child a cochlear implant.
Totally. Yeah. And that conversation, I think, is really an interesting one. And it is, I think you're right, a good kind of, like, entryway into this conversation where it's like, you know, deaf culture is a thing.
Yeah.
Like, deaf folks have a culture that is very important to them. And for you to come in and be like, no, I fixed it for you, it's like, well, no, I don't need fixing.
Yeah,
like,
I'm fixed your kid. Now your kid can just talk. And it's like, yeah, but everybody else in our family signs.
Yeah, exactly. So. Right. And I think that, like, I think it's also when you push back against people who think they're doing a good thing, who think they're being helpful, they get really defensive, right?
Yeah.
Like, and this happens a lot. And I think I see this, you know, in a lot of, you know, you see this in NGOs, even outside the disability space, you see this in lots of people who really want to help, right? They think they're doing the right thing. thing. They think that they're coming in and they're really like, you know, spending their time and money on something that's going to help people. And when you tell them, like, actually, you're not helping. In fact, you're kind of making it worse. People, I think, inherently feel defensive about that. And so when it comes to things like the future of disability, when you say things like, no, actually, like, you trying to invent a way for these people to not exist is not only not helpful, it is harmful. People get really upset and get really defensive. But I do think that, like, having these conversations over and over again, I hope on the show, does kind of slowly get people used to them. And so, and also, like, having disabled folks on the show is important to me.
Yeah.
Because, like, again, like, disabled people don't, like, go away in the future. And almost all of science fiction sort of assumes that they do. Like, if you think about, like, my friend Ace wrote this really great piece for Gizmodo about, like, why the fuck there are so many stairs in space. Like, why are there so many stairs on spaceships? Like, this makes no sense at all. And she's a wheelchair user some of her time. And so, this idea, like, if you think about, like, all the sci-fi out there, like, how often do you actually see a disabled person? Very infrequently. Yeah. Like, it's not like disabled people just, like, disappear in the future. Like, unless we've literally killed them all, which is a horrible dystopia that we're pretending isn't a dystopia. Like, you can't really, I think, talk about the future without talking about everybody. And that includes disabled people. I mean, there's millions and millions of disabled folks out there. So it's really important for me to have disabled folks on the show talking about, like, where they fit into these futures. And that's kind of, like, a big piece of what I'm trying to do. Like I said, on Flash Forward, is, like, opening up what the future means and who gets to talk about the future and who gets a say in the future on the show.
Oh, it's so important. I mean, my little version of a microcosm of that is that I recently, so I'm working now as a therapist, you know, while I'm working towards my PhD, and I am finally starting to see clients. And, you know, I'm learning a lot in that experience of working with people who are seeking treatment. But the population that I'm specifically with right now are adolescent girls, most of whom they're in the foster care system. So most of them have, you know, severe histories of abuse and neglect because they live in a group home. And so I went to a family child meeting, which is like a meeting where periodically these girls have all of this support. It's their social workers and maybe their CASA workers and potentially their parents even, or their foster parents or other people who have been close to them throughout their lives. And, you know, some of them have large child family teams and some of them have smaller child family teams. But I remember going to one of these meetings where we were talking about potential placement out of the group home and into a situation with the foster parents. And it was just like a bunch of people talking about this child as if she wasn't sitting right there.
Yeah.
And I mean, 100%. She's like 15. Like, you know, she's, you know, she has some issues of mental illness, obviously. She has all of the expected things that would happen when you've been victimized over an entire childhood. But she's strong and capable and beautiful and brilliant. And like, there would be all these times when they're just like, well, this is what's best for her. And this is what we should be doing. And I just wanted to be like, why don't you just ask her?
Totally.
I'm so annoyed by this. And you're right. It's that on a macro scale with, you know, people everywhere. Like, the percentages are way higher than people think. You have people in your own life. You have people who you have met and you, like you said, either they have a hidden disability or the reason that you haven't met them is because we aren't making it accessible for them to come out and be in the same spaces as we are. And that's just a huge bummer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't, the episode about exoskeletons, right, where I talked about, like, you know, would you people want this? The two interviews that I did was this guy who, he's an engineer at Virginia Tech, came in being like, I'm going to make exoskeletons, I'm going to help people, you know, I'm going to do this thing for people. And importantly, it was for him, he was like, I have a brother who uses a wheelchair. And this is really important. Like, I'm doing this because I think it'd be great for him. And it turned out that he had never actually asked his brother if he wanted that. And when he did, his brother was like, no, like, I love you. And I'm excited that you're excited about this thing. But, like, I don't want to use this. Like, I guess I would use it if you invented it just to, like, make you happy, but, like, I wouldn't want to use it regularly. Right. And so they had this, and I had both of them on the show, and they had this, like, really interesting conversation about it. And it is, I mean, like, these are people who love each other deeply, right? That, like, have a really good relationship, who've lived in the same home for many years, right? They grew up in the same place. And even then, like, the fact that he never thought to ask, like, what do you want, is mind blowing.
Yeah. And it says obviously less about him as a person because, like you said, he deeply cares about his brother and obviously has only ever been concerned about, you know, making decisions that are supportive of him. It says so much more about how we're conditioned as a society.
Totally. Yeah. Like, and I mean, he said he was like embarrassed, right? He's like, I can't believe I like just assumed this, you know, and they had this great conversation and it is, but right. Of course, like, cause you're taught, we're conditioned from a very early age that like disabled people can't speak for themselves, need to be taken care of, you know, like, and need all us to make decisions for them. And that's largely not the case.
Well, and even beyond that, that they are other, that we are normative and they are other. And actually you and I weren't even taught to be normative cause we're women. Right. But like, even beyond that, like there's always this societal narrative, this ethnocentric monoculturalism of like, this is normal and all of that other is other.
Instead and should
like,
be fixed. No,
there's like a fixed, relieved, removed, helped, whatever you want to think of it as. And it's like such a bummer. It's that's why I thought it was so cool when that Canadian, you remember there was some like Canadian ad campaign with people with Down syndrome in it. And there was like all this pushback because first people were like, this is really infantilizing. But then other people were like, no, this is really empowering. And everybody had an opinion. And then finally, like two different people with Down syndrome were like, well, this is what I think. And they thought two different things and people's minds were broken.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
What are we supposed to think? If these two prominent people with Down syndrome don't agree. And it's like, yeah, because they're two different people.
Totally. Right. Right. It's like, how do you skirt? Like, it's like being seen, right? Like that whole thing of like visibility is important. But also you don't want to veer into like inspiration porn, right? Which is this like idea, but it is amazing. I mean, like, a friend of mine says that, he jokes about disability and he's an organizer in the disability space. And he's like, yeah, disability is the only sort of marginalized community that you can like join against your will, basically. Like anybody can become disabled at any time, right? Like it could happen to any of us at any moment. And like, because of that, there's so many disabled people. It's a huge amount of people. And then also that like, of course, I mean, like, not all women agree about stuff, right? Yeah. Like not all Black people agree about stuff. Like not all Asians agree about stuff. Like, but like, of course, not all disabled people agree about what should and shouldn't happen. And like the idea that we want, and this happens, you know, not just for disabled folks. I think in general, people like want marginalized groups to like appoint a person who's going to tell us white people how to think, you know, and like tell us what the right thing is.
Just tell me what you want, and then I won't keep making mistakes around you. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a shitty like colonialist view.
Totally.
But you're right. It's so dominant. And people are having these conversations. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we can sit here and go, not enough people are having these conversations. Sure, because not everybody's having these conversations. But a lot of people are. And that's why I think it's so cool to listen to podcasts like yours, to podcasts that have, you know, a social justice component to them that are by people who give a shit, you know, and they might not be by big organizations and they might not be funded by huge grants or funded by advertisers. Some of them are, some of them might not be, but that's why I think things like Patreon are so important, is because like there are people out there who are having the conversations that matter, and sometimes they're not that popular and sometimes they might not be that marketable. And because of that, you know, they really do rely on the support of the people who care to keep them going. And that's why it's so cool that these sort of content creators who give a shit are able to fund their work, you know, like you and I rely on Patreon. We rely on ad sales for our shows, you know, and sometimes we might rely on different small grants and things like that. But these are not, you know, shows that are paid for by Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
It's just like, we're not that lucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that Coca-Cola would be down with some of the flash forward. Yeah. It is always right. You're skirting that. Like, I think it's important to like talk about unethical business practices by giant corporations and then like turn to them and be like, hello, please buy an advertisement.
Give me your monies. Oh, but also I'm not willing to say that you're anti-GMO. Is that okay?
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's another big thing. It's like, I want to be selective about my advertisers, but I also don't want to shit on an advertiser who does like amazing stuff, except this one thing they did, which was obviously for marketing reasons, I disagree with ethically. So I'm always having to talk to them and be like, see this thing where you talk about this being a superfood? Can I just like leave that out?
And they're like, yeah, that's cool. It is so funny. I do think that like people don't really understand the like amount of work that scrupulous podcasters, not, I guess not everyone does, yeah, about advertising, right? Where you go through the list, you look at the website, and then you're like, okay, some of this is okay. And then some of this is like, ooh. And then, yeah, like I'm like so paranoid that I'm going to advertise for some company that turns out to be evil. And so I do a lot. I like literally look up every company on like the Better Business Bureau to see if like what people are complaining. And like, I just like Google, do a lot of research to make sure that like the company isn't, you know, like run by an egomaniac person who's probably going to like have a melt, you know, like or whatever
and
it is.
And even still, I think it's going to come out. Like they're going to have a Me Too moment later and you're like,
totally.
How can I, not see
I know.
Coming?
And like at some point you can't, like at some point who can know, like whatever. But I don't think that like listeners necessarily know how much time we spend like going through and being like, and then also, yeah, going back and forth being like, okay, well, I'm not going to like read this line of copy because this is pseudoscience, right? Yeah. Like, can I say
really,
this instead?
Yeah. Like, this really isn't central to the product. It's just sales. But I had that problem. I read ads for years for a food delivery, one of those box delivery companies that went anti-GMO halfway through our campaign. And people were like reaching out, like, how could you back this person? I'm like, first of all, they're backing me. Second of all, I have a contract with them.
Right.
Like, I completely agree. Like, I reached out to them and said, I disagree with this decision. And it's, I'm just not comfortable actually using this as a selling point because my listeners would eat me alive for this. The food is still good. I hate that you felt the need to go anti-GMO because you thought it would sell more boxes. But
what did they say?
They were like, yeah, we get it. But I was like, I'm in a contract with you. Like, I have to fulfill my side of the obligation, you know?
Totally.
Like, And I tried to make that apparent to my listeners. I think most of them got it. But it's the same people who are like, I can't believe you read ads. It sucks when you read ads. Yeah. I'd rather there be no ads.
I mean, and it's like, yeah, at some point it's like, cool, are you going to send me like $2,000?
It's like, sorry, fast forward through them if you really, fast forward. Flash forward.
Yeah.
I love it.
Flash forward. Totally. No, it is. It is like, I feel like I don't get that very often. I think that like people at this point understand that like you have to make money somehow.
Yeah,
but,
me too. But early on, I remember it was a struggle. And I remember giving friends who started podcast advice, like, guys, if you can get advertisers early, do it. Or just start trading with other people's podcasts even before you have enough listenership to like really be able to sell ads.
Definitely.
Because you got to get your listeners used to it. Because if you go halfway through and all of a sudden you drop ad bombs on them, they're going to be like, where the hell did this come from?
Yeah. No, I know people who like have had shows that they've gotten really popular and they've been like, okay, I guess I need to put ads on. And they've like been so freaked out about what people will say, which is such a bummer. Cause like, if you like a person and you think that their work is like worth consuming and you want to come back every time, like, don't you want them to make money? I don't know. Yeah. Like, I get it. Like, ads are ads. Like, right. We all like don't love ads, right? Ads are not like something everyone's like, ooh, goody, let's listen to some advertisements.
I'm actually excited about them. But like, I have a lot of like companies where I'm like, ooh, they send me like cool bars with cricket protein and ooh, I got a free month to my favorite meditation app. And then I went out and bought a lifetime, you know, membership because I use it all the time. So every so often it's like a match made in heaven and I'm like, oh, thank God I got like legit.
Yeah. That's great.
Here.
Yeah. I just feel like as a listener, or at least as someone who consumes the work of like somebody that you like, it's hard for me to like get mad that they're getting paid. I don't know. Like,
oh, it's so true.
For me, yeah. Like, I don't know. I get it. Listeners are like, oh, like we liked it, but we don't want to listen to ads. But like, unless you're willing to pay me money, like you don't get to complain. I don't know.
I so agree. It's like, this is free, you guys.
Yeah.
And I think everybody listening right now is like, yeah, Kara, shut up. That's why we Patreon. So I appreciate that, you guys. I really, really do, because it is absolutely necessary. Gosh, Rose, we haven't even... Okay, I've kept you way too long already, but I always close with the same two questions. I'm going to get to them. But before I do, is there anything like new that you wanted to talk about? Anything that you're, you know, interested in now? We did talk about how season 5 just dropped. So of course, guys, definitely check out Flash Forward. Listen to the newest episodes. By the time this airs, which I think is going to be in like 2 weeks, you'll have another episode there. So you'll already have two in season 5. What else? What else you got going on?
That's like the main thing. Mm-hmm. I just joined Wired as a columnist, so you can read my thoughts on the future every month there. But that's really the big thing. Flash Forward's like the main thing I'm working on right now. I have a couple pieces. I have a piece coming out in The Goods about the future of face masks. So like as a fashion accessory in our polluted future, like how do you make a mask sort of take off? Like what is it? I'm really interested in this idea of like, how did sunglasses become an accessory that like everybody wears? You know, like that's kind of weird that you're like covering up a big chunk of your face.
Yeah.
How did people like sell that as a thing? And
like
what would that take?
People have like started or like taggers, they'll wear like the cool masks that have like a skeleton over their mouth.
Right. Like Burning Man people also wear them. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And then I also have a column at Motherboard, which actually relates to some of what we've been talking about, which is called Design Bias. And it's all about sort of the ways that technology or science or the world in general is sort of bias designed by people with a certain user in mind. And sometimes that user maybe doesn't line up with everybody needs.
Yeah. We talked about that on the show when I had an engineer on recently, a woman engineer who does like built spaces. And she's a professor at USC. And we were talking about, I've had so many USC engineers on lately. It might have been this other engineer. But anyway, we were talking about, you know, the two most famous examples are like the facial recognition that like, was like miscategorizing African-Americans as basically apes, which was like, like, how could that not? And people are like, it's not racist. It's facial recognition. And it's like, no, it's coded by like a bunch of white people. And also, remember the one about the sinks, like the electronic sinks, and they just like couldn't recognize certain skin colors?
Come up actually again because the self-driving cars have been shown that they're more likely to hit a person who is darker skinned because they use that same kind of like contrast recognition as a like, that's a human body.
Yeah. They're like, what does a human look like? Well, white, obviously.
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly. Right. And it is also, it's not even that. It's like what the sensor, the like light detection on the sensor requires a contrast, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have like light against dark, right, that's what it says. It's like, oh, that's skin.
But the fact that they are like, well, then that's an adequate sensor. That's the problem, right? That's not how you sense people then.
Right. It's like also, I mean, the bathroom sink thing is such a famous example in engineering that like, I thought we had like gone over this. I don't know. I'm kind of like, how about we like, did you just not pay attention to that part or did you just not think it would be an issue? And now you have these cases, this sort of engineering cases where self-driving cars or driverless cars are potentially going to be hitting Black people more than white people, which is like great.
Yeah.
Just great.
Yeah. Ugh, geez. It's so true. So I'm glad that those are things that you are, you know, focusing on in your coverage, obviously. And I really am always really fascinated by the intersection of sort of the future of science and technology, or maybe I should say the future of technology, but informed by science, society, history, social justice, because all of those things really come into play. And so I think it's really cool that that's sort of at the intersection of basically all of the work that you do. That's why I think your work is so important. So
thank you. It's fun for me.
I'm so glad. So A, I'm really glad that you came on the show today and I want to thank you for doing that. And B, can I keep it for like a couple more minutes to ask you my closing questions? Okay. So when you think about the future, which you do all day, every day, because that's your job, I want you to tell me, number one, if you had to pick a single thing, which I know is not easy to do, what are you most concerned about? What keeps you up the most at night? What are you maybe even a bit pessimistic, maybe even a bit cynical about, like, ooh, not looking good? And on the flip side of that, what are you most excited, optimistic, legitimately hopeful for?
Okay, so first thing, that's a tough one. I'm generally cynical. So there's a lot of choices on that one. Yeah. I think that climate change is probably the most obvious one. But I think that it's sort of climate change and the consolidation of money and power in the world. So those two things I think go hand in hand. And the latter, that consolidation of money and power is the reason why we're not doing anything about climate change.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, there's so much evidence that like, what you and I do doesn't really matter. It really matters what like the 100 mega companies in the world and like the big countries do.
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing that feels so intractable to me, where it's like, what do we do about this like continued consolidation among those top 100 companies and people who just have like more money than anyone should ever have and power?
And then when we're fighting against our own government, basically, because we're fighting against those corporate interests within our government.
Exactly. Right. So that's, I think, the thing that feels the most scary to me, where it's, you know, we all recognize that this is a problem. We all know that this is happening. And in fact, like, the solutions are relatively straightforward. I'm not saying they're easy, but like, we know what we need to do.
Yeah.
It's not like we don't know what to do. And yet, like, there is this huge chasm between what we need to do and what it getting done. And that is like just full of money. It's like a big giant money pit that like none of us can access. And so I think that's the thing that is the most scary to me. The thing I'm the most hopeful for, I think, is I'm really stoked on the student protests in Europe right now, the climate protests that the students are doing. I don't know if you've heard about this, but like there was this student who basically decided that every Friday she was going to skip school.
Oh yeah. Wasn't she, is she like Scandinavian?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Northern kind of European.
I yeah.
And I, super cool. She's become like a
yeah.
model for.
Totally. I think it's kind of like the equivalent of the sort of Parkland students mm-hmm. yeah. in the US. They've kind of become this symbol of sort of a thing that we all know needs to change and we all know is like inherently broken. Well, I guess we don't all know that, but I think like the vast majority of Americans are yeah. pro like gun regulations, like sane gun regulations. And I think, you know, those students have become kind of the face of that renewed movement for gun control. And I think in Europe, there is this group of students now who have become the face of climate change protests, and they've skipped school and sat on the sort of parliament steps in various locations every Friday, one Friday a month, I think it is, or something like that. I should actually know better the details on this, but that I feel like, I mean, it's a small thing, and whether that will actually make any difference, I think is hard to say. But I do think that like they're getting a lot of attention and they're getting a lot of press, somewhat similar to the kids in the US who are suing the US government about climate change, which I think is an interesting tactic. I'm not mm-hmm. sure will work, but I think is like, you know, worth trying because nothing else is working.
Yeah.
And so I think that like those, when I see, you know, groups and people who are, you know, from the ground up really trying to change something and getting a lot of attention for it, it always makes me feel hopeful. Of course, the like devil on my shoulder is always like, it still doesn't matter because they're not going to change the behavior of those like 100 mega companies.
Yeah.
But I think that like at some point, and we saw this with a less intractable problem, but we saw this with things like antibiotic resistance, right? That like there was a ton of press and coverage and protests about big mega farms using too many antibiotics and causing a ton of this sort of spread of antibiotic resistance. And it worked. They actually, like Tyson and Purdue and all these companies on their own volition without government regulation actually changed the way that they farmed things mm-hmm. and actually changed the amount of, you know, antibiotics they were using and sort of really did actually change their behavior. And so I would hope maybe that there can be a similar movement that isn't maybe government run, because that seems like it's not happening, at least in the US for the next couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the new Green Deal will get people excited. I hope so. But yeah, I think that like seeing, I don't want to be cliche and be like the children will save us, because I think that actually that's like a dangerous narrative that like defers responsibility by those in power
yeah,
who and, should be doing more.
And but, unfortunately, it's the children who are going to inherit this like horrific
right.
problem, and which is why they give a shit, right?
And right. That's right. Why, and it's also like, I mean, like with yeah. the Parkland kids, it's like literally their classmates were shot. Like yeah. if that's what it takes for us to like be like, oh, look how good the kids are. I don't know. It just feels very dystopian to me right now.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. What else is interesting? I feel like those are like, yeah, seeing people actually like who care. I mean, like you said, like people who actually like seem to give a shit. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's like not enough people who care. And I feel like seeing more people who care always makes me excited.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's hard to care when you've learned, it's not hard to care, it's easy to care. But for a lot of people, we live in a society of like learned helplessness, right? Like there's the famous yeah. rat study where they electrified the floor of the cage and then shocked the shit out of the rats. And the rats like tried to escape, but they couldn't because there was no place to escape. And then eventually they actually opened the door. And when they shocked the rats didn't try to escape anymore. And that's learned helplessness. Like after long enough of like this browbeating, you stop trying. Because you start to feel really, you know, you start to feel like the trying that you have been doing for so long doesn't matter. And it's a psychological block that's very hard to get over because it's incredibly powerful, which is, I think, why children capture our attention so much. It's so promising to see them reach out. I mean, obviously it's impactful, especially when they've experienced such a horrific trauma and loss. Like you can't help but be affected by it. But on top of that, they haven't learned helplessness yet. You know what I mean? They're still hopeful. And sometimes hope, I think, is kind of like arson. Like if they can light a fire and it actually does inspire enough people who maybe are operating on this learned helplessness playing field will remember what it was like to try and escape. You know, and they're going to start doing it again. And so that's, I get it. Like, I think that it's a great thing. And you're right. The narrative of like, let the, you know, inheritors of the future clean it up is horrible. But kids inspiring adults to affect change, I think, is like really promising, and we're seeing it happen left and right. So hopefully it's going to continue. But also, like, come on, we need to get off our own asses too.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I'm just looking up the name. I'm trying to get the details on this children who's skipping school. And it's like, I think it started in Belgium, it looks like, according to this BBC story.
Oh, okay, cool.
And apparently it's grown to like tens of thousands of kids, who more than 30,000 students and others turned out in three Belgian cities. And that's actually down from the week before, where it was more than 30,000.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, who knows what will happen, but it is always, yeah, I don't know. I'm so cynical, because I'm like, okay, but we, like, we can yell and scream all we want, but like, the people who need to do something have like plugged their ears and are pretending like we don't exist. So I don't know. I don't want to like still end on a down note.
No, but it's true. The cage is locked. You know, there's certain aspects where no matter what we do, we can't escape. And yeah, at a certain point, you stop trying. So we got to figure out workaround. We got to Jimmy the cage open.
Yeah. Right. The like, get a hold of those shocking devices so we can shock the people in power.
Fuckers. Why are they doing that to these poor rats?
Exactly.
Gosh, Rose, this was so much fun. I'm so glad we were finally able to make the timing work out, that we were able to chat, that it's, you know, decent weather in the Bay Area and in LA. So the intertubes worked in our favor. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This is so fun.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.